to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in an email or favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the last five are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. This time we're going to be talking about emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're going to be talking about how it affects us and what we can do to encourage it in ourselves and also in our participants. So I think that oftentimes when we start out, we define what we're talking about. So let's start by what is intelligence? What does it mean in this context, not in the IQ test type context where it's just schooling, but what does it mean in the context of a negotiation, a seminar, a workshop, a mediation? What does it mean to have intelligence in this context? Pardon me. And I see we have lots of participants. Thank you all for being here, lots of people here. And thank you for your participation. Let's see. Nagina says, and this is really a really good example, a real base example of intelligence. She says it's the ability to learn and understand. Intelligence is the ability to learn and understand. Good point. Yeah, that's a real foundational definition. Mm-hmm. Patrick and others are saying that intelligence in this context is the ability to comprehend trying situations, the ability to comprehend trying situations. We have the ability to comprehend, well, what the discussion's about, what the alternatives are, what people are saying, and why they are perhaps saying it, which goes to emotional intelligence, of course. Mm-hmm. Ellen and others are saying that intelligence is the ability to use information. Good point. That's the ability to learn and understand and to use the information that we have been given so that we can comprehend trying situations. Wow, we've got a wonderful definition going. Thank you for all of your participation. And, you know, a lot of people, Sean and others, are giving definitions that I'm going to call mental acuteness, that you're alert, you are capable of comprehending and understanding. Are you paying attention? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually intelligence in this context really does have quite a bit to do with paying attention, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So now that we are understanding what intelligence is in the context of our discussion, what's emotional intelligence? Why is that different than just intelligence? Because a lot of people are smart, mm-hmm, and they are capable of understanding and of looking at something in a critical manner and looking at research and thinking about it. Mm-hmm. But they don't have such good emotional intelligence. So what is emotional intelligence, and why is it different than just regular intelligence? Which is not just, of course, but why is it different than the intelligence that we've just talked about, the ability to learn and understand type intelligence, as Najina and others are saying? Mm-hmm. Oh, here's a good definition. Imala says that emotional intelligence is the ability to analyze our own emotions. That's very different than just plain intelligence, isn't it? The ability to analyze our own emotions. We have to know what it is that we kind of feel, don't we? Because how our own emotions impact how we deal with others, how we see them, how we, well, decide if they're being reasonable or not. Yeah, our own emotions have a great deal of impact on that. The ability to analyze our own emotions. Mm-hmm, yeah. We've got quite a few answers, and thank you for all of your participation. That emotional intelligence is the ability to control our feelings. People use the word gut reaction. That's kind of our impulses, our first reaction to something, our first opinion, just what we think, wow, that's right, that's wrong, that's bad, that's good. Our gut reaction is kind of our first impulse, our first thought about it. And we all have that, even if we don't actually express it, which, of course, we would not. We'd have to think about it. But that's the ability to control that, to think about our gut feelings, our first impressions. Quite a few people are saying that emotional intelligence is the control, the ability to control outbursts, to not just say what your first thought was, right, but to consider the repercussions. Mm-hmm. The ability to control outbursts, not just say it. Whoa, this is good. This is bad. This is, you know what I mean. You get a gut reaction, you think about it, but you don't actually say something. Emotional intelligence is the ability to control our outbursts. What a good thought. It's really the ability to be circumspect, to really consider what the repercussions of our actions and our words will be. Yeah, to really consider why, what it is that is happening, and whether or not we should make an oral proclamation about it, right? Right, yeah, outbursts. Mm-hmm. You know, Tristan and others are saying that really emotional intelligence is our ability to understand how our response will impact others. That's the ticket. That really is. That's pretty much sums it up. Tristan says our ability to understand how our response will impact others is the definition of emotional intelligence. And that goes to our outburst, to our body language maybe. Yeah? Don't want to make a definite facial expression that shows how you feel. Have to remember that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ability to understand how our response will impact others. Yeah. People are actually talking about physical responses too. Kind of a physical outburst, something that is just your reaction, and then you do it, and then you're kind of sorry, like jumping up or leaving the room or slamming something, right? Those physical reactions impact others too. Mm-hmm. Ability to understand how a response will impact others. Good point. Mm-hmm. Kelly says not only others, but impact the situation, which, of course, is impacting others because they create the situation, but how our response will impact reaching our goal. Yeah, impact the situation, impact what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And Brian says that our response can, emotional intelligence is thinking about how our response will impact the group dynamic. Mm-hmm. We've talked about group dynamic before. Now, if you want to hear prior shows, the last five archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows archived on the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about group dynamic, but it really impacts all that we do, doesn't it? Because it's so pervasive. The group will have a feel to it. The participants will have a relationship to each other. And this group dynamic, which is indeed impacted by our response, whether we're a participant, because we are influential to others even when we're a participant, but also especially when we're a leader, because the followers, the other people in the group, will look to us to create the group dynamic. And you can have a group dynamic that is enthusiastic and goal-oriented and has the ability to negotiate and to listen to others. Or you can create a group dynamic that's closed, that is just not capable of change, and that, well, if it is capable of change, of course, but you need to change the group dynamic for that. And that is what we want to prevent. We want to have an open dialogue, an open group dynamic that is enthusiastic to reach our goal. And it is our common goal, isn't it? Yeah. So let's talk about this. We've talked about intelligence, and we've talked about what is emotional intelligence. So let's talk about our theme. How does our emotional intelligence impact the other participants when we're members of the group? Let's talk about being group members first. Well, oftentimes we are first group members before we are leader, right? Yeah. And how does emotional intelligence impact the other participants when we're members of the group, when we're a participant? Yeah, this is an interesting point. Thank you for all of your participation. Eddie and others are using the words peer pressure. And that's really peer pressure to act like everyone else. If the group dynamic is going a certain way, there will be quite a bit of peer pressure to act like the other people so that we can all be similar to each other, right? Yeah. Peer pressure to act like everyone else, the emotional intelligence impact that. And there will be pressure on us to conform, right? Because there's oftentimes pressure to conform. If the group is, well, people are saying of one mind. If the group was of one mind, then there wouldn't be any pressure to conform because we already would have conformed, right? We'd all be marching in the same direction. We'd all be on the same step. The trick is that if you've got peer pressure, you can influence that with your emotional intelligence. If you feel that there should be other discussion, that there should be other issues. Yeah. A lot of people, Justin and others, are using the word groupthink. And we've also discussed groupthink in the past, and it's certainly very important to emotional intelligence and to the idea of peer pressure and the group dynamic, because that's really what creates groupthink, right? Prior shows, recipeforpeacenow.com, last five, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow for all the shows, including the last five. So groupthink is really when the group has so much peer pressure and so much group dynamic going that everybody buys in. Everybody has the same opinion that's being said. Yeah, groupthink, it really is what it means. The group thinks as a group and not as a set of individuals. You know, this is a very good point. Justin and others are making it. I'm making groupthink sound bad. And perhaps that's my emotional intelligence bias, right? Right. And I have to think about that because it's a very good point that group dynamic and groupthink are oftentimes a good thing. They lead us in a certain direction. They cause us to have a goal. They cause us to have a path. Yeah, a lot of times groupthink is really good because it means that the group dynamic is solid and we're in agreement. See, we think of these things as kind of a negative. Groupthink is bad, it's peer pressure. But no, it could go both ways. like everything else with human beings, really, it could go in both directions. You could have groupthink that is very focused, that really allows us to reach towards our goal. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that, yeah. So groupthink could be a positive act of emotional intelligence on the part of all of us. We've all agreed. We're participants on the same page, same goal. Or it could be that might not be to the advantage of reaching the ultimate goal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it slices both ways like everything else. You know, peer pressure slices both ways, really true. You know, we think of peer pressure as a negative, like teenagers forcing other teenagers to do something that's really bad for them. The old, if everybody jumped off a cliff, would you do it too? You ever hear that expression? Maybe an Americanism, but there's probably a counterpart in every language. And, of course, this is a global show. But it means, you know, would you follow the herd? Would you follow the group if they were all doing something really stupid? So we think of peer pressure that way, but it's not necessarily true. The conformity may be a good idea so that we can go forward with unification. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Celeste and others are saying that the main thing about groupthink is that, especially if you've got it, that it's often a cultural response. Mm-hmm. The people in the group are of the same background, basically. And so it's a cultural response. It's something that they know to be a good idea because it's culturally ingrained. Yeah. You know, Anna and others are kind of maybe disagreeing. Well, not exactly disagreeing. But they're saying that it's not just a cultural response. It's a learned response also. Mm-hmm. That you can, well, other respected authority figures could have taught it to you, and you don't even think about it anymore. It's become kind of an ingrained idea, an ingrained ethic, an ingrained group think, I suppose. Yeah, culture response. Culture responses are kind of learned responses, aren't they? You grow up in a culture and you kind of absorb the teachings of your parents, your peers maybe, but especially the authority figures, your parents, your teachers, the leaders of your group. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's kind of a fine line there. Mm-hmm. Diane says that groupthink is a preconceived idea response. A preconceived idea. Well, I suppose that's true. The cultural and learned responses create preconceived ideas in us. You know, people are using the word bias and bigotry and prejudice and things like that. Maybe. I mean, I'm not exactly disagreeing with you, but I think sometimes the responses are a way of understanding the world that are not negative to someone else. See, bias and bigotry and prejudice and like that are negative responses, and of course that can be a preconceived idea. And it can even be a learned response. And those are negative, but you can have positive too. Yeah, because you have to think about that. When we have emotional intelligence, we understand which way the response is going. Does that make sense? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bertram says you can have that groupthink is instructions from a third party. Instructions from a third party, an authority figure maybe. Oh, Bertram thinks that the instructions come from the group leader. We're going to get to group leader and emotional intelligence in just a second. But yeah, sometimes if you've got a fairly strong leader, and even if not, maybe the discussion will do it, the appropriate response will be suggested, for lack of a better word, will be told to the group. Uh-huh. Yeah, because of instructions from a third party. Sometimes those instructions are kind of detailed, huh? Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a interesting point about respect. Kira and others are using the word respect. Kira says respect of the other participants will create followers of your actions. Respect of the other participants will create followers of your actions. If people think you're smart, if people think you're right, if people want to follow you because they respect your abilities, they respect your opinions, then this will indeed create followers. And if we've got followers, then what have we become? Yes, thank you. We're the group leader. Yeah. Sometimes groups have a selected leader, somebody who got the group together, for example, the person who's got the physical facilities, for example, the person with the most computer skills to keep us all in line, to keep everything moving, the most organized person. These people can be, of course, the leader, but sometimes we get chosen as the leader because of our skills, because of our emotional intelligence, because we've gotten followers, within the other participants. And people are always asking our opinion. What do you think? Do you think that seems right? You know, that makes, sometimes there's a designated leader, but we're kind of really the leader. And so, yeah, it's a good point that sometimes we do become the designated leader, or at least we share with the other person. Because I don't like to, if it's a group that's trying to have a successful meeting of a goal, a good goal, I don't like to have someone be, these people calling it dethroned, but someone no longer have a position that they really enjoyed and thought they would want. Yeah, that's kind of a delicate negotiation. And you need to be, of course, cognizant and have the emotional intelligence to know if the person who was the designated leader, who you're kind of replacing in its way, should really still be a leader and you can be you can be partners, you see. And that's a good point that sometimes if they're kind of not leadership material, that they don't really want the role, and they'd be just as glad that you take it over. But you have to negotiate that. You have to think about it. So now that we're talking about leadership, how does emotional intelligence impact our leadership? What does it have to do? How does it impact our leadership skills and our leadership style? Yeah, which makes a difference, too. You know, Sherry and others are saying that emotional intelligence impacts our leadership when we understand our followers so that we can gain their trust and respect. Ooh, such good words. Understand, trust, and respect. You cannot be an effective leader if you do not understand your followers, understand the participants, and they do not view you with trust and respect. If the participants don't have trust and respect for the leader, the group will not go forward. Because somebody has to say, let's move on, right? Somebody has to say, well, let's talk about this. Somebody has to be the leader. Yeah, it's really just that simple that somebody has to say, you know, this is how we're going to do it. This is what needs to be done. And also to delegate tasks. Good point. Yes. And that is a skill in and of itself, isn't it? Yes. So a lot of people are saying that emotional intelligence really impacts your ability to delegate tasks, because you need to understand the strengths of the various participants and their weaknesses too, let's face it, so that you can understand who can handle this, who will be good at it, who will be capable, who will follow through. Yes, very important. Sometimes people are more than capable, but they don't have the time, the will, the drive to really follow through, especially in a timely manner. We need to go forward. We need to get to a conclusion. We need to reach our goal. Yeah. So that's very important, that the followers have trust and respect and that you understand them. So how does that happen? Balance says you can create empathy for dealing with different opinions. Emotional intelligence creates empathy for dealing with different opinions. You know, we have talked in the past about the fact that empathy is not the same word as agreement. Mm-hmm. You don't have to agree with somebody to have empathy for them. Empathy means really what Sherry said, that we understand our followers. I understand where you're coming from, mm-hmm. which is kind of an Americanism, but it means that I can understand your viewpoint. Mm-hmm. I understand the foundation for it. I can ask unbiased questions. And we can go forward, yeah, with empathy for dealing with different opinions. And that empathy will cause us to be good at having people be civil. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anne says you create empathy for accommodating participant differences. Actually, that's true, and that's somewhat different than differing opinions, right? Emotional intelligence of a leader creates empathy for accommodating participant differences. Because quite frankly, even if you come from the same cultural background and like that, well, we're all humans, and humans have different ideas, different opinions. And partially it's caused by our own life experience, yeah. The ability, the empathy, the ability to accommodate participant differences. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, quite a few people, Catherine and others, are using the word referee. Now, I don't like to think of myself as a referee, and I'm sure that you don't either, really, kinda. But sometimes the leader really is one, right? And that's where our emotional intelligence kicks in. The ability, Catherine says, the ability to successfully referee any disputes and enforce the civility rules. Ooh, the ultimate emotional intelligence. Things are getting heated. Hmm? Yeah. The participant differences are showing in an uncivil manner. We need to be the referee. We need to keep the group dynamic positive and keep everyone's emotional intelligence civil. And we need to do it before it gets out of hand. Yeah, we've talked about the civility rules lots. And really, they're quite simple. I know a lot of you have returned. And thank you very much for being here and for all of your participation. We've got some new people, too. And thank you for being here. Please come back. The civility rules are really basic. No rudeness to someone else. Give someone their turn. No interrupting. Those kind of rules. And you can see that people are starting to argue vehemently. Mm-hmm. Maybe not actually get rude. We haven't reached that point, but it's starting to get there. That's one of the main uses of emotional intelligence, so that you can talk them down, so that you can know when you're going to have a timeout and we're all going to have something to eat and cool down. And you can go around and talk to the people individually. Yeah, all good things. So, now this is a very practical show, of course. We don't just talk about theories. And the next question is being asked by lots of people, and thank you for all of your participation. And so we've got this wonderful thing called emotional intelligence. We've talked about it. We've talked about it from a participant standpoint. We've talked about it from a leadership standpoint. But the question that a lot of people are posing is, how do we develop this emotional intelligence? How do we develop it? How do we know when we've got it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What should we do? Because we are a practical show, and we don't just talk about theory. We talk about how to do it. So what should we do to develop emotional intelligence? You know, it's always growing, always developing, because we are people, and as people, we keep going. We develop. We are people that are interested in other people, and we need to reach a successful goal. So how do we develop our emotional intelligence? How do we work on it? How do we make it better? Mm-hmm. Alejandro says, by listening to all of the participants. Yes, because you come in with a certain amount of emotional intelligence. You've got your own emotions in check, right? And every time we have a response, we understand that it impacts the whole group, that it impacts others. But what do we do with this group specifically, right? The one that's in front of us, the one that we're dealing with now. And we have a lot of agreement with Alejandro that we develop emotional intelligence by listening to all of the participants. How are we going to have empathy with them if we don't understand them? How are we going to have emotional intelligence to deal with getting to the goal if we don't understand what everybody's opinion is of how to get there? You got to listen. Yeah, listening is a very important skill, listening to all of the participants. Mm-hmm. Deborah says that the main way to develop emotional intelligence is by recognizing and controlling our own preconceived notions. By recognizing and controlling our own preconceived notions. That has to do with our response at the group. And controlling our response, controlling and recognizing our own preconceived notions. Yes, because we're people too, and whenever we have a group, whenever we do a mediation, a workshop, a seminar, whatever it is, just a talk really, we have an idea based on our experience. This is true, our leadership experience usually. We have an idea of how it's going to go, right? And that's really, that's not a bias or bigotry or prejudice. It's just a thought about the group, about what it is that we're going to accomplish, how far we're going to get today, mm-hmm. how long the process is going to take. We have all kinds of thoughts, really preconceived notions about how it should go and how long and what we're going to do. And really, oftentimes we've got kind of a preconceived notion about how people are going to react, right? Especially after we have dealt with this specific group before. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You got to recognize and control that. And be willing to look and see and listen and observe and understand and have empathy for what's happening now. What's happening within the group? How the group dynamic might shift? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You need to recognize and control our preconceived notions so that we're open to understanding that something has changed or something is different than what we thought. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a very good point Joseph and others are making, that one of the best ways to develop emotional intelligence towards a group, towards anybody really, is by understanding the issues thoroughly. You got to think about them ahead of time and not just what you think should be done or what you would do in the same situation, but you have to look at the issues and say, wait, let's understand all sides. Let's look at the research, right? We've talked about making I'm going to call them subcommittees, but delegating some research tasks to various members of the group so that they can bring the research back to the group and give it ahead of time. Remember how important it is, we've talked about this before, to have the research, if it's something to be read, something that needs to be looked at, to have it disseminated ahead of time. You know, email attachments are a wonderful thing. And so that we're not all sitting there trying to read it and grasp it and participate at the same time. There's nothing worse than having a bunch of people with their heads down reading something while you're talking or somebody is trying to make a point about it. Yeah, you need to see it ahead of time. That's one of my rules. If you're going to have something that needs to be read, some sort of research, you need to give it to us ahead of time so we can really think on it. So understanding the issues thoroughly is a real good step towards emotional intelligence. Good point. I kind of like this one. I'm afraid that this is a preconceived notion, of course. And let's face it, I have this preconceived notion. And I have to always think about it because really it's not true. It's just a mindset. Tina says that the way to develop emotional intelligence is by realizing that you're not always the smartest person in the room. Yeah, we're getting a lot of agreement on that one. You will develop emotional intelligence as a leader by realizing that you're not always the smartest person in the room. Isn't that the truth? Because really, we kind of think, well, at least I think most of us kind of think, that we really know what needs to be done and how it needs to be done and the process and like that. And if people would just follow us more closely, it would get done, right? Right. But it's a good point. That's a real good point of emotional intelligence to understand that you're not always the smartest person in the room. You know, I always say I learn something when we do these shows, and I hope you do too. And you have to be open to learning. Because a lot of times, you know, these shows are not scripted. They are organic. They go however it is that the conversation goes. And oftentimes I don't expect it. But you have to be open and not just this is how it's going to go because this is how I've done it before, and it'll take 2 hours, and we're going to get, this is what we're going to delegate people to do, and then we'll be done, we'll reach our goal, and goodbye. No, you're not always the smartest person in the room, especially I'm not always the smartest person in the room, and that's where the emotional intelligence comes in, with the empathy, with the thought, with the listening. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even quite a few other people are saying that the way to develop emotional intelligence is by getting to know the participants as individuals. Yes, getting to know the participants as individuals, not as symbols, not as representations of a certain mindset or a certain group or a certain cultural thought. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have to get to know the people as individuals, and the other participants need to get to know each other as individuals. And yes, this goes to people going, yes, we're going to have the, yes, we are, we're going to do the recipes. This goes to the Recipe for Peace Now idea of having some food in the room and of calling a timeout, a let's take a break. Mm-hmm. So, and having something to do during that break, which is very get-to-know-each-other, group-affirming, find out something in common, and we're not sitting around formally discussing the issues moment. Mm-hmm. And that's what food is great for. Now, I'm going to say the same thing that I say every show. And I know I say it every show, but it's so important that I'm going to repeat it again. I know. Yeah, quite a few. You're starting to do the words exactly. Well, yeah, I don't do the exact same words, but yeah, same idea. You're right. And thank you for all of your participation. It's exciting. And if you're going to have food, and you are, because it's a good way to, well, I don't like to say the word network because it's so overused, but it really is, to get to know each other as individuals because it gives you a break that is informal and we could get together and talk about the food to start out with. What is that? How'd you learn how to do that? Oh, that's so delicious. Yeah. If you're going to have food and remember that the food is a tool to get us together. I mean, we might be hungry also, but it's really a tool. It's not meant to be necessarily a meal. It could be, but not necessarily. Although I like to have lots of food, so it probably is a meal. It's a tool to get us talking to each other. That's the sole purpose of it. So we're going to, and whenever you have food, you need to take a survey amongst the participants. You do it however it is you've been communicating, probably email or phone or whatever, and you tell it to everybody that if somebody has a food allergy, a food prohibition, or a religious prohibition to a type of food. Very important, because you don't want somebody to have a bad moment. It's supposed to be convivial. Also, you're going to ask people to label what is in the food, not what it's called, meatloaf, but what is actually in it, make a list of it, so that I can run my eye down it and see if I can eat this. Yeah. And I suppose this is my notion, because I hate to run out of food, it makes for a bad party. I think that the host, which is oftentimes the leader, really, even if it's not your facility, but you're really the host, you're the person leading it, should have some extra food. Bring a little extra, just so we don't run out. People have different notions of how much to bring, and there's always someone who brings nothing. And I think you should have at least one safe dish. Now, what makes a safe dish? Well, it has not too terrible many ingredients. The ingredients would be something that your participants would be familiar with and would have eaten before. And it, you've taken the survey, nobody should have a problem with it. Yeah. So a safe dish, something that people can really for sure eat. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they've seen the pieces before, and it doesn't, not too big a list and like that. So let's do our safe dish. I think we're going to have time for both of them today. Sometimes we really don't get to the second one, do we? Oh, well. That's all right. We do it the next week. So this time our safe dish is going to be a potato and cheese pie. Oh, it's so delicious. It's really kind of like a gratin potatoes, let's face it. But it's layered, and if you, the parchment paper around it, so it doesn't stick, you can get it out kind of solidly in wedges. If you want, you can use a square pan also and make squares. The squares, I guess, are a little easier to get out, but the middle ones will squish. So I kind of like the pie, the round tin concept. Come to think of it, I like a springform pan. I really like those springform pans because you can get everything out in one piece and it looks so pretty. Okay, so here we go. We're going to have not too much butter, about a nice big pat, maybe two, a couple tablespoons of olive oil, two garlic cloves that we're going to crush. You think I use too much garlic, which people seem to think use one. Let's have 2 cups of breadcrumbs. Nice and fine breadcrumbs. In the United States, and I know this is a global show, and all really in a lot of places, breadcrumbs come in a container. You don't have to make them. Of course, you can if you've got dried bread. But breadcrumbs come flavored. Personally speaking, I kind of like the Italian flavor, but that's just me. But use plain ones if you think it's going to be too intrusive. Let's have a cup of grated cheddar cheese. 3/4 of a cup of grated Parmesan, and 10 roasting potatoes that we're going to real thinly slice. We're going to peel them, of course, and just thinly slice them like with a mandolin, really thin slices. Otherwise, it will be kind of a gummy pie. So, yeah, you need to make the thin slices. Food processor is a good point, too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're going to preheat the oven to 350. We're going to grease. I'm going to use a springform round tin. It'll make the pie more pie-shaped. And quite frankly, if you don't use a springform, it will not come out as solidly. Because you know how you just push it up and it all comes out and you don't have to scrape around the edges. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to get our springform. It's the kind with the hook. People ask me what a springform tin is. It's round. I don't think, is there such a thing? I don't think there is. It's a round tin, and it's got like latches on the side and a movable base. And when you latch it, it makes a firm round tin. You put everything in it. When you finish baking it and you go to serve it, you unlatch the side and you push up on the bottom and the whole thing comes out. And you don't have to mess with trying to dig anything out of a tin because it's already all firm, all there. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to take that tin that we just greased and we're going to line it with some parchment paper. Mm-hmm. We're going to double do this. We're going to line it with some parchment paper. We greased this so the parchment paper would stick. Right, right. So we're going to now heat our butter and oil in a frying pan, stir in the garlic, make it nice and yummy, make it smell nice and be sort of translucent. Now in a separate bowl, we're going to combine our breadcrumbs, our cheddar, and our Parmesan. We're going to take a nice layer of our potato slices and put it in the bottom of the springform tin. Brush with some of the garlic butter that we just made, right? Sprinkle with some breadcrumbs and cheese mixture. Another layer of potato. Another brushing of the garlic butter. Another breadcrumbs and cheese. You've got the picture. At the very end, at the top, we're going to have a layer of potato, and then we're going to sprinkle it with the mixture again with the breadcrumbs and the cheese on the top so it'll melt. You know, we're gonna reserve some so it's on the top. What we've done is we've layered it, right? Mm-hmm. Delicious. Now, I usually have kind of not such a tight product there because, you know, you layer it, you sprinkle it, you layer it, you butter it, you sprinkle it. You know, it's not real firm. I usually press down on it like meatloaf. I press down and make sure that it is compacted in the tin without actually breaking the potato pieces. This is not a contest. You just kind of press it down firmly so that it's in there evenly and it's all to the edges and stuff so that everything's a little bit adhering to each other without squishing. You want the slices to look nice. You don't want to squish the slices, but you give a kind of a press. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're going to stick it in the oven, bake it for an hour. Gets nice and golden. That's when you look at it and decide if the hour was enough. And before we serve it, before we pop it out of the tin, we're going to let it rest for about 10 minutes just because, A, it is really, really hot, and, B, it will firm up a little bit. So that's kind of important. You let it rest at the very end. Then you serve it. You can bring this and rewarm it. It is just excellent. Use a really, really sharp, maybe even wettish knife, and it will make lovely pieces. Very popular. And that is our safe recipe. Yes, it has cheese. Everyone can see it. It is on the list. Mm-hmm. And therefore, people can decide if that is something they can eat. But you would have taken your survey and know if someone has a dairy allergy. Yeah, okay. So this is our, so that's our safe recipe. Now we have time for our adventure recipe. Now what makes this an adventure? Well, first of all, it's got shrimp. And a lot of people are allergic to shellfish or don't eat shellfish. Mm-hmm. Allergic to it, they have a religious prohibition to it. Mm-hmm. And it's also got wine. And some people, I know people would argue with me that wine gets cooked off, the alcohol gets cooked off. Probably true. But some people do not want wine in their food altogether. They just don't do the alcohol. So if you've got people that can eat shrimp but they refuse to do the wine, you could substitute some stock, some chicken stock. It will not, however, be as tasty. Here we go. So this is a shrimp pasta. Now, I usually say that although traditionally people sometimes use fettuccine for a creamy, shrimpy type thing, I do not usually advocate using such messy pasta. It's hard to dish out. You need that little pronged spoon thing, and it's messy. It's hard to get on the plate. It drips. It hits the carpet. All bad things. So I usually say to use a type of pasta that is little pieces, like a rigatoni, a bow tie, something that is easy to spoon out is the key to it, and not something long and narrow and kind of messy. Okay, so here. We're going to have like a package, a pound of pasta. We're going to prepare it, cook it al dente, drain it, set it aside. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's cooked. We're going to have a tablespoon of olive oil, nice oil. Let's have a large onion. I prefer the sweet kind of onions, like a Vidalia or something. Do not use something really bitter in any kind of cooking is my take on this. Mm-hmm. We're going to have, let's have a couple cups of shredded carrots. That's probably, depending on how big your carrots are, maybe about four of them, depending on how big. But it should end up to be about a couple of cups. I like to shred them or chop them, make them small so that they look nice. Mm-hmm. Let's have two cloves of chopped garlic. A couple of pounds of medium shrimp, not those little squiggly ones. They're you know how they have those little teeny squiggly shrimp? Don't use those. Use, but be sure that your shrimp are deveined and deshelled. If you can't buy them like that, quite frankly, I'm going to use frozen, let's face it. Frozen you need to thaw and pat dry, of course. So let's have a couple of pounds of shrimp that are shelled and deveined. You can't get them that way, do it. I do not usually like to see the tails either. I think it's messy, and sometimes the little hard pieces get loose. A cup of white wine. Do not cook with a wine that you would not under any circumstances drink. Mm-hmm. People do it. If you wouldn't drink it, you don't want to eat it. So nice white wine, not terribly expensive, but something that's really not, you know, really bad. A cup and a half of half and half. Do not use anything less like milk. It won't look nice. It won't be good. And let's have a little bit of minced fresh parsley just because it looks really nice with the cream sauce. Okay. So we've cooked our pasta, right? So in a nice big pan, frying pan, we're going to put the oil, and we're going to add the onion and the carrots and the garlic, and we're going to cook until the carrots are still crisp. They haven't gotten mushy, but they're cooked through, and the garlic is cooked through, and the onion and everything. And now we're going to add our shrimp. That'll take about 5 minutes. We're going to add our shrimp and stir fry it for about 3 minutes more, add the wine. We're going to reduce the liquid by half by stirring it in the pan. And now separately, we're going to put the half and half in a bowl. We're not going to add it to the pot. We're going to put it separate. We don't want to curdle. And we're going to add the mixture. We're going to let the half and half warm up is what we're doing while we're cooking. So we're going to add the half and half very slowly to the onion and wine and carrot and garlic mixture. Very slowly mix it in. Mm-hmm. Going to add the parsley now. You could sprinkle it on top, depending on how you feel about it. I kind of like it to be added in because I don't like stuff on top that has to be mixed through, although it's pretty. Stir, 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 because you don't want it to catch on the bottom of the pot or to curdle. Mm-hmm, yeah. It'll take about 2 minutes. The sauce is now thickened because you've already reduced the wine to half by simmering. Yeah. Stir. Delightful. You know that pasta? If we've kept it warm, we will just use it. If not, we will rewarm it. Quite frankly, I use the microwave. Well, you know, hey. And we toss the pasta with the sauce, whichever way you like it. Personally speaking, if I've got a big enough skillet, I like to toss the pasta into the skillet with the sauce because then you don't waste any. You stir it all around. It's also a good way to warm the pasta if it's gotten kind of cool. So you toss it into the whole skillet. You mix it all around, all coated, all yummy. Put it back in the serving bowl. Ha, you've got it. This is actually, if you prep the shredding and the cutting and the chopping and like that ahead of time, this is actually, and the pasta, makes the pasta first too. This is actually a good recipe for making together as a group. Now, it's kind of, if you've got the facilities in the room, it's rather a bonding experience. You know, I always say cooking together, but then people argue with me that it's not really cooking together, it's watching somebody cook. And this is true, because I don't like everybody to get near the fire or sharp objects. But it's kind of bonding. This is almost a stir fry, right? It doesn't take very long. It smells wonderful. And you can put this sauce together as you are standing and talking and getting to know each other. And it gives a focal point, right? And so that's why I like a stir fry and a quick recipe like this. Mm-hmm. If you've got the facilities, it's a really good one. It's a good one. It smells good. Everybody likes it. And, yes, it's a good point that if you left out the shrimp, it would be a safe recipe. Well, the wine. Well, all right. But you could substitute chicken, which would be fine and would make it less likely to be unacceptable for some reason. Yeah, for the shellfish reason. Yeah. Remember to cook the chicken, please, ahead of time. Yeah, do not bring raw chicken. You need to cook it because you need to, if you're going to make it quickly like that, even if not, you need to cook it first. It needs to be cooked, cubed chicken. People are going ham. Yeah, whatever it is that you'd like to put in there, put vegetables in, yes. But in any event, that is our adventure recipe. And a recipe like that can be made with the group. Oh, so much fun. And I see our time together is nearly up. Thank you very much for all of your participation. I always learn something. I hope you do too. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. If you would like to contact us with recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. Website is www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Last five shows, including this one, just as soon as we get off the air, are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for all of your participation. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.